Welcome, and thank you for standing by for today's conference call. At this time, all lines have been on a listen-only mode, but for the duration of today's conference call, we're going to go ahead and open up all lines. So all lines will be open and interactive for today's conference. So I will remind parties that should you need to mute your phone, you can do so by pressing star 6 to mute, star 6 to unmute, and toggle back and forth as needed to speak. At this time, I also need to remind parties today's call is being recorded. If you have any objections to the recording, you can disconnect now. We'll turn the call over to Barbara Reynolds. Ma'am, give me 1 minute to open the lines.
Okay.
And all lines have been opened.
Great. Thank you so much, Jeannie. Good afternoon, everyone. Happy Thursday. Happy middle of December. We just saw some snowflakes here in D.C. I hope you are not experiencing that. I know the weather is crazy. Thank you very much for taking time out today to dive into this very obviously important topic and somewhat complicated topic of budgeting for evaluation. I did just want to introduce myself and give a little bit of context for this session before I turn it over to my colleagues. As Jeannie said, I'm Barbara Reynolds. I'm the training specialist for grantee training and technical assistance with AmeriCorps State and National here at the corporation. It is my pleasure to work very closely with Diana Epstein, who will be our presenter today and who is a part of our research and evaluation unit here at the corporation as well. So Diana, along with her team, along with Carla Ganuel, our expert here at State and National on evaluation, together this group of folks have put together a very, very detailed and incredibly useful curriculum on evaluation. And this course that you're seeing today and that you're experiencing is one part of that curriculum. And so I just want to make sure that those of you who are joining us understand that this is one session that is incredibly useful for you, hopefully for the folks that you work with, and that you're aware of the broader curriculum as well and that you're making use of that. So to that end, I posted the link to all of those courses. They are posted on our Knowledge Network, and you should see that link in the chat box for yourself right now. If you are online and you don't see the chat box, look for a little icon and the word chat. You may just need to click that to open up your chat box. But to, you know, again, draw your attention to the broader curriculum that exists to support you, I want to make sure that you see that link to the Knowledge Network. So as you get into the session today and as Diana takes it over, you'll notice that the audience for this curriculum, for this course, is really our prime grantees with the corporation. And what that means is, the folks that we're talking to are the staff or the directors of the state service commissions who work with sub-grantee programs across the country. We're also talking to staff and directors of national programs or tribal programs. And so that's really the level at which this material has been developed for you. It is absolutely our hope that you're able to turn this around for your own purposes, right? If you're working with your own sub-grantees on evaluation, hopefully this course material and the curriculum overall could be useful for you. So just wanted to make sure that you understood, again, where this comes from, who the intended audiences are, and then how it's hopefully going to be of use to you. As you did here at the beginning, we are recording the audio portion of this, and we will post this file, the audio file, on the Knowledge Network right along with the slides for this presentation. So if for some reason you have to log off today or you want to share this with others in your agency, you'll be able to do that once we are finished for today. So as I said, that will be posted on the Knowledge Network as well. So please chat in any questions or comments to me as Diana is speaking. I'll be monitoring that chat. I can certainly try to respond directly to you in the moment, or I can bring those questions to Diana on your behalf as well. So please feel free to do that. And again, I just wanted to say welcome and thank you for taking time. And it is my pleasure to turn it over to Diana Epstein. Diana, please take it away.
All right. Thanks, Barbara. So my name is Diana Epstein. I'm here at the Research and Evaluation Office at the corporation. And we also have Carla Ganuel on the line. So if you have more programmatic type questions that come up, hopefully Carla may be able to answer some of those. So we recognize that budgeting and evaluation, and especially the two together, may be sort of an anxiety-inducing topic, but we want to have you not worry. We realize there's tension around evaluation and what it costs, but the goal here is really to try to give you as much helpful information in this particular session as we can. So even if you're just getting started, if this is your first experience with AmeriCorps grants, really now is the time to start thinking about evaluation so that you can start investing in data collection systems and other procedures that'll really help you over time. So now's the time to be thinking strategically about these topics. So my plan for the session is to pretty much get through the material with a couple of quick pauses, and then I'll be sure to leave time at the end for questions. I'm going to cover a lot of the more common questions throughout the presentations, and I'm also going to talk about some cost-cutting tips towards the end, so just know that that will be coming. Okay, so for this presentation, we've identified the learning objectives that you see here. So we hope that by the end, you'll be able to understand why budgeting and investing in evaluation is really a strategic investment. Recognize how evaluation costs vary by the type of evaluation. Explain the key components of an evaluation budget, and then identify approaches for creating an evaluation budget. This presentation is informed by emerging trends in evaluation, many of which have really important implications for evaluation costs and budgeting. So first of all, the traditional rule of thumb that you may have heard that had guidance, you know, to devote a certain percentage, 5 or 10% of your budget for evaluation. And this is really proving to be too simplistic. Evaluation costs vary widely, as I'm going to explain later. Also, better data collection and data infrastructure is leading to more useful administrative data sets that can be used to conduct low-cost randomized control trials and sometimes also quasi-experimental design evaluations. So data collection is often a really large cost driver, so utilizing existing data sets has the potential to drive down costs. Third, the tiered evidence grant programs, which emphasize rigorous evaluation practices, such as the Social Innovation Fund here at CNCF, are rapidly expanding the number of high-quality evaluations that are going on. And these efforts are providing really important data about what a typical evaluation budget is. And then finally, more organizations, including us at CNCF, are embracing the idea that there's really a continuum from performance measurement and performance management all the way to program evaluation, and that oftentimes data you collect for one purpose can be used at least in part for another purpose. There can be a lot of challenges to budgeting for evaluation. So paying for an evaluation can be hard because many programs feel like they can't afford it or they don't know how to find resources through low-cost evaluation partners. This is complicated by the fact that funders won't always pay the entire cost of an evaluation, especially if that funder is giving restricted dollars. However, as I mentioned before and will continue to mention, there are lower cost ways to conduct an evaluation. So we here at CNCS, we definitely acknowledge these budgeting challenges, but we also believe that evaluation can and should provide critical insights into your program. We feel really strongly that program evaluation goes beyond just meeting requirements, and in fact that it provides important information for your program's management, decision making, and program improvement. We view evaluation as a smart strategic investment in improving your program, and then ultimately as a stepping stone to serving more people more effectively. So we'd encourage you to view evaluation as a strategic investment in future growth. If you can demonstrate to funders and to donors that your program works, you can become more competitive for their limited financial resources. So spending money on evaluation is not a trade-off. We'd encourage you not to think of the money you spend on evaluation as money that you could have otherwise spent helping people. Instead, think about it as money spent so that you can maximize how you help people. If you do program evaluation in a sustained way, it'll provide critical information that you need for program learning and management decision making. If you invest in evaluation, it demonstrates to current funders and potential future funders that your program is committed to efficiency and effectiveness. So it's important that you consistently demonstrate to stakeholders that your organization is continually building evidence and then using that evidence to refine and improve your program. If you include evaluation as part of your organization's formal budget, it demonstrates that evidence and informed decision-making is an organizational priority, and then it's part of your operating culture. This can really speak volumes to potential donors and funders. So remember, the ability to demonstrate impact can be a differentiator in an environment like we're in now where there's really scarce resources. So from a funder's perspective, you know, why would you want to spend scarce money on things that aren't working? And likewise, you want to spend money on things that are working. So as you begin to plan your evaluation, step back and put the evaluation in the context of a longer-term research agenda. So it's really important to remember that you don't have to evaluate your whole program at once, and in fact, you shouldn't. It's better to, you know, lay out a series of studies looking 5 or 10 years in the future about what you might want to learn. So lay out studies that build upon one another and that will at the same time allow you to create complementary resources that you could use multiple times. So you can do this by working backwards from an end goal. So let's say you ultimately want to achieve a strong level of evidence for your program, and to do that, you think you want to do a randomized control trial or a quasi-experimental design. So if that's where you want to get, what supporting steps do you need to take to get there? Maybe you start with descriptive studies, collecting routine data, then maybe you then administer a survey, do a process evaluation, and invest in additional data collection instruments. So here's a concrete hypothetical example of what I'm talking about. So consider the long-term research agenda for a hypothetical AmeriCorps program that provides housing assistance to low-income communities. The program eventually wants to demonstrate that it has a positive impact on beneficiaries by implementing a randomized control trial evaluation. So this is a very worthy goal, but the program would be wise to build up to that point by investing in a number of earlier steps first. So for example, in step one, the program might start by collecting data on the families it serves on a regular basis. Then next, it might design an annual survey and collect pre- and post-outcome data every year using that survey. Next step, step three, would be an implementation study to assess if the program's actually being implemented with fidelity to its logic model. So then, assuming that it is being implemented well, the program could then start to collect longer-term outcome data from families by designing and then administering a follow-up survey, maybe, let's say, 1 year after the end of the program. And then finally, in step five, knowing that, let's say, the demand for the program far exceeds the available resources, the program could implement a randomized control trial by randomly assigning families to receive housing assistance. So all the necessary data collection instruments have already been designed and tested in those earlier steps, in the earlier evaluation years. And the data is already being collected routinely from the families that are served. So to do this more rigorous evaluation, all the program really has to do is collect the exact same information from families who aren't receiving housing assistance. So the idea is, by incrementally fielding studies as part of a long-term research agenda, not only has the program gradually built up its evidence base, but it's put these systems in place that made the final, more rigorous evaluation much less costly than it might otherwise have been. Okay, so let's turn now to budgeting for evaluation. So in general, evaluation budgets should reflect the expectations of stakeholders, particularly in terms of the scope, duration, and level of rigor of the evaluation. You have to consider any requirements you have or mandated components of funding. So for example, CNCS AmeriCorps grantees that receive over $500,000 a year are required to conduct an external impact evaluation covering at least one program year. So it's important to take that into account when you're considering what kind of evaluation you're going to do. The evaluation budget has to be appropriate for the particular research design that you're going to use and the key research questions that you want to answer. So certain methods, like primary data collection, simply cost more to execute than other methods. Budgets have to be of sufficient size to ensure that the evaluation is high quality and rigorous. If you underfund an evaluation, it can result in design choices that really do jeopardize the integrity of the evaluation. It can also lead to last-minute workarounds, shortcuts, and quick fixes that could seriously impact the results. Okay, so broadly, there are three main buckets of factors that influence evaluation budget estimates. First are the program factors. So for example, the number of sites your program has, the geographic characteristics of those sites, how spread out they are. The second is the evaluation design. So the type of study design that you use to conduct your evaluation and the key questions you ask do have implications for your budget. More sophisticated designs, like randomized control trials and quasi-experimental designs that use control or comparison groups, are typically more expensive, but not always, as we'll talk about. The types of data collection and data sources that you use, that also affects the budget. So typically, it costs a lot to develop and field a survey, for example. If you have analysis of your data that uses really sophisticated statistical method, that's probably going to require some technical expertise, which can also increase cost. And then the last bucket here is reporting, dissemination, and use. So it's very important that your budget has enough resources to document the evaluation findings and to prepare reports, briefs, and other presentations to share those results. You also need to consider time and resources to discuss and reflect on the findings by your staff and by other external stakeholders, too. So we're often asked to provide information about the average cost of different kinds of evaluation designs. However, I have to tell you, there's really not much publicly available information out there. So we've done the best we can, and we've gathered some data from another federal competitive grant program. So we acknowledge that this may or may not be representative of all evaluation budget data, but we think it's a helpful starting point for this discussion about what evaluation of AmeriCorps programs costs. So the important takeaway from this slide, we won't get into all the details. The important takeaway is that budgets do vary, and that the ratio of evaluation budget to the overall program budget is much higher than those old rules of thumb. So for example, looking at the bottom, second to the bottom line, the non-experimental evaluations, here we see that the average evaluation to program budget ratio is 16%. If you look up the chart at the QED rows, the quasi-experimental designs, the PSM just means propensity score matching, it's just one technique. But look at those lines, the QED lines. The average evaluation to program budget ratio there is, you know, also about 16%. So it varies widely. Looking at the same programs, this time organized by level of evidence, we can see that as you increase the strength of the evaluation design, both the average and the median evaluation budgets increase. So evaluations that would produce a preliminary level of evidence, so that's a non-experimental evaluation that didn't use a control group or a comparison group, the evaluation to program budget there was about 15%. But evaluations producing a strong level of evidence, so those that were randomized control trials with a randomly assigned control group, that had the highest ratio of evaluation to program budget, and that was at 28%. So just keep in mind, budgets vary, they depend on the design, they depend on the level of evidence you're trying to generate, and budgets really do reflect the research questions that you're asking and the design and the methods that you're using. So the key themes that emerge from the analysis that I just showed you and from other recent evaluations are shown here. So first, the existing rule of thumb ratio of 5 to 10% of a program's budget for evaluation, that leads to serious underbudgeting for evaluation. The bare minimum percentage is somewhere around 13 to 15% for non-experimental evaluations and some quasi-experimental designs, but realistically, it's probably more like 20%. For randomized control trials, the percentage is probably at least 25%. However, I want to make sure that we point out that the percent of the program budget isn't the best way to allocate evaluation funds. So you have to consider the cost in dollars as well as percentages. So for example, you really can't conduct an evaluation that targets a moderate level of evidence, like a quasi-experimental design, for less than about $75,000 a year, unless you've gotten some time or resources donated or you're making use of some lower cost options. Third, given the current state of evaluation methods, it's really not possible to conduct a rigorous evaluation on a complete shoestring budget. So if you want to conduct a robust evaluation with targeting a high level of evidence, you have to be willing to budget for it. But again, we want to emphasize that costs vary based on the study design. The last point is just remember that you're investing in valuable evidence that's going to serve more beneficiaries more efficiently and more effectively. As you develop a long-term research and evaluation agenda for your program, it's likely that the costs will decrease because you're going to have data collection systems and instruments in place, and those are going to decrease costs. It's important to keep in mind, as I've mentioned, that any type of evaluation design can potentially be expensive. So even an implementation study could be expensive if it had a lot of sites that were very geographically dispersed. Even so, there are ways to conduct most types of evaluation inexpensively, including some randomized control trials. One way is to build sustainable data collection systems and instruments that you can use over and over again. So you make one big upfront investment with smaller tweaks over time, and you can use those resources continuously in the future. Also, if you continuously collect relevant information, like, for example, the data that you're already collecting for performance measurement, that can significantly reduce evaluation costs. You can also reduce costs by using existing administrative data sets, which I'll talk about more later. So the bottom line here is that you need to determine what you want to learn from your evaluation and then build a budget that can answer those questions. So there's a few options for finding financial resources for your evaluation. So first, you can tap into local resources, like partners of your program or local collaborators that might have a stake in the information you're going to collect and the results that your evaluation would generate. So some ideas are universities, local consultants, community colleges, cooperative extensions. They may also be able to pitch in. And many of these groups, honestly, are just interested in the intellectual challenge of helping to design a high-quality evaluation. It may also be possible for you to join forces with other programs that have similar interventions or similar outcomes. So for example, a year ago, the Public Land Service Coalition commissioned a quasi-experimental design evaluation of 14 different Conservation Corps programs that had similar outcomes. So the group was able to pool together their resources and then generate a large sample size that was provided for by multiple programs working together in the same evaluation. So that may be an option for some of you as well. Keep in mind that there are some foundations that will award grants or provide money to evaluate programs, and we've listed a couple of those up here. And then finally, keep in mind that evaluation is an allowable cost at CNCS. We're going to talk about this more as the presentation continues. So before we get into the specifics of how to create an evaluation budget, I want to step back for a minute for a high-level view of a program's overall budget. So evaluation is one piece of your overall budget. So as you start to think about how you would budget for an evaluation, first think about your overall program budget. So we've laid out a couple of pie charts here. So the pie chart on the left shows all the different costs that are part of operating one particular hypothetical AmeriCorps program. So this is actually a real example, but just one particular program. So evaluation is one piece of the pie in this program's budget, as you can see in the chart on the left. The pie chart on the right shows sources of funding for program costs. So in this example, we see that the program has a really diverse funding strategy that includes state and local money, federal and private grants, corporate gifts, gifts from individuals, and then revenue from fundraisers. So we recognize that not all programs have such a diverse array of funding sources, but cultivating this type of diversity is critical to building a sustainable long-term funding strategy. So in thinking about how to allocate funding from these diverse sources to the various cost items in an AmeriCorps budget, it's useful to think about the difference between restricted and unrestricted funds. So in the pie chart on the right, it's likely that the state and federal grants will be restricted funds, meaning that there's pretty strict guidelines about how funds can be used. So foundation and corporate grants and individual gifts, on the other hand, might have fewer or no restrictions on program costs. So those kinds of funding sources offer greater flexibility. Some restricted grants, though, do allow funds for evaluation. So in the case of AmeriCorps grants, evaluation is an allowable cost. But also, of course, there are restrictions on cost per MSY. So it's not realistic to expect that a high proportion of evaluation costs will necessarily be included in the CNCS share unless you can start to shift some other program costs out of the CNCS share and then have them covered by other funding sources. Programs that rely really heavily on restricted funds may have to develop new strategies to raise funds to support evaluation. So in this case, we used a small grantee's budget, so a grantee under $500,000, to construct the example. So without evaluation costs, the grantee match rate was about 34%. When evaluation costs were added to the budget, we assumed that the CNCS share stayed the same, the grantee match rate rose to 48%. So what did this grantee do to cover their evaluation costs? First, they required sites to contribute cash match, which was not in the original budget. And second, they increased foundation, corporate giving, individual giving, and fundraising revenue. So they have unrestricted funds from fundraisers and individuals that account for 7% of the budget. And all that revenue can be used to pay for evaluation. So I'm going to actually go through another example at the end of the presentation to show how you might start thinking about shifting costs around. Okay, so as I've just mentioned, funders might stipulate that certain funds be used for only certain purposes. So as you, I'm sure you know, funds can be restricted or unrestricted regardless of the source. It really just depends on the stipulations of the funder. So if you can't get all the federal money that you need to pay for your whole evaluation, you're going to have to generate some additional revenue. So there's three options for doing this. First, you could raise additional unrestricted revenue to cover evaluation costs. Second, you could raise additional restricted revenue where evaluation is an allowable cost. So for example, you could try to get a foundation grant that specifically covers evaluation. And then third, you could shift some other allowable costs out of your CNCS budget to restricted grants that would support those costs. So for example, you might be able to shift a portion of your personnel costs to another state or federal grant. And by doing that, you'd free up some additional money in the CNCS share for evaluation. So the point is that you really need to think broadly and strategically about the entire universe of possible ways to raise money for your program, and what are the sources where you can most likely get unrestricted money if that's what you need. Conversely, where could you use restricted funds to pay for other portions of your budget? Okay, so as I said, evaluation is an allowable cost at CNCS, and as you know, AmeriCorps grantees submit a new budget every year, and we do allow grantees to request different levels of funding every year. It's true that we don't expect a program's cost per MSY to increase from year to year. So in practice, what that means is if you're going to ask for more evaluation money one year, you'd have to ask for less money for something else. So one point that we want to make that hopefully you've heard about is that we will allow grantees to carry over evaluation money from year to year. And the logistics are still being worked out. But if you have questions about this at the end, Carla and Barbara and I can try to answer them. But let's assume you didn't want to carry over any money. So that's a good starting point for this example, where you're thinking about really the whole pie of funding. What money can get paid from CNCS versus match? Think about the entire budget in whole. So here's a hypothetical example on this slide. So let's say in year one, I have $25,000 in member training and then $10,000 from CNCS for evaluation. Okay? So that's $35,000 from CNCS. Second year, same amount, $35,000. However, this year I was able to raise $25,000 in matching funds for evaluation. Or maybe I got some additional unrestricted fundraising revenue. Okay, then in the third year, I found a source of match funds that would pay for member training. So now I don't have to request training funds from CNCS. Instead, I can ask for more money from CNCS for evaluation. So the key here is that you can have some flexibility in your budgeting. You create and you submit annual budgets, so you could increase or decrease evaluation to some extent as you need. So in this example, in the year two, we needed more money for evaluation, and also in year three. So we want to encourage you to plan longer term and focus other fundraising efforts on your evaluation needs. So think of evaluation as not being really any different than your other organizational costs that fluctuate every year and that you have to figure out how to manage within the AmeriCorps budget constraints. But by planning ahead, it's going to help you build a better plan and then cultivate resources more proactively. Okay, so I'm going to just pause for like 2 minutes if anyone has any burning questions right now. Okay, hearing none, we will move on. Okay. So the next part of the presentation is going to include some details about evaluation budget planning. So when you're thinking about what resources you need to conduct an evaluation, first consider who's going to conduct the evaluation. If you're a grantee, you know that you're going to have to use an external evaluator. If you're a small grantee, you might be using an external evaluator. You might be using your own program staff. If you're going to use your own staff, an internal evaluation, you have to anticipate the extra hours that it's going to take to complete those evaluation activities. Similarly, if you're using an external evaluation, think about what services are going to be included and what's not included in that cost. So even when you hire an external evaluator, you also are going to have to invest some staff time in managing the evaluation. There's going to need to be staff time for monitoring the evaluation to make sure it's moving forward as planned. That might mean regular meetings with the evaluator to check in on status updates, if there's been any setbacks or challenges, any additional resource needs. The point is that having program staff invested in the evaluation process is going to help you ensure that an informed and well-planned evaluation is produced in the end. There's five main components of an evaluation budget. The first is staff and subcontractor or consultant time, so labor. and that's often a very big budget. Second is travel, which is often to sites for data collection or to meet with program staff. Third is other direct costs, which you may have heard referred to as ODCs. So that's things like printing, postage, communication supplies. There's overhead costs and fees, which are, you know, operating expenses, like the cost of office space, for example. And then there's the program costs that we just talked about that are necessary to support the evaluation. So I'd encourage you to talk to an evaluator as soon as possible so that you can get multiple quotes from them and get a better sense from an expert about what your evaluation should be costing. I'm going to talk about each of these five components in a little more detail. So first, if you're using an external evaluator, a big component of your budget is going to be labor. So that's the cost of paying the evaluation staff salary and benefits while they're conducting your evaluation. So when you're estimating the cost of external evaluator time, it's really helpful to estimate the time or the number of hours they'll need to spend performing work in planning the evaluation, selecting and developing data collection instruments, obtaining information approval from an IRB, an institutional review board, collecting data, and then processing, analyzing, and reporting that data. Mm-hmm. So major cost drivers are typically data collection and analysis. So if you're fielding surveys or conducting interviews, you're likely going to need to budget for a lot of hours to be spent collecting data. If you need to analyze large data sets or do interview transcriptions, those can also drive up costs because they're very time intensive. Finally, don't underestimate the time that should be spent planning the evaluation and then reporting the final results. You really need to make sure you budget for both of those adequately. So here's a sample chart that plans out the amount of time you need, amount of time needed to complete various evaluation tasks, which are listed down the row. So you see that the tasks here are planning, preparation, data collection, analysis, and reporting. And then this chart is also divided up by staff member type listed across the column. So we've simplified this by just listing the time to complete each task in days. But many contractors or consultants will offer an hourly rate instead. So if you want to use hours, just multiply the number of days by 8 hours a day. So here you could estimate the number of days that each given staff member would spend working on each of the five evaluation tasks, and then multiply that by their cost, their daily rate, to get the cost per staff member per task. And if you added all those up, you'd get a total cost for each of the five evaluation tasks. Another way to do it is to organize the same information just flipped around. So here the chart is organized by staff members listed down the rows, and then the tasks are listed across the columns. So it's the same idea. Multiply the daily rate for each staff member by the number of days that that member spends on each task to get the total cost per task for each person. And then add across all the columns, so in other words, across all the tasks, and you get the total cost per staff member for the whole project. So on both of these slides, you can see that the time required for each task varies by staff member. So there are some tasks that can be performed by less experienced staff who are usually less expensive, but there are other tasks that do require more advanced expertise. And those are going to usually have to be done by staff with higher labor rates, more expensive staff. So how do you estimate labor rates? This table here shows sample labor rates charged by private consulting firms and a university-based consulting service. So the rate for the private consulting firm reflects estimates for government clients only. The government often negotiates these prices. So the rates for other organizations might be slightly higher or lower. So worth mentioning that oftentimes certain departments in a university will offer sort of a la carte consulting services in a given subject matter area. So for example, education or statistics. It's hard to get those rates publicly, but we did poke around, and we found some rates from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and we found that a PhD student consultant would charge $50 an hour, and let's say a manager or director would charge $150 an hour. So it really does vary, and it's worth sort of asking around in your area. So next we turn to travel costs. So often an evaluation is going to require travel for evaluation staff to go to program sites to collect data, or even travel to go to your organization's headquarters for various meetings. So it's important to include a line item in your budget for travel that would include, you know, transportation by plane or train or car, ground transportation at the site, lodging and meals, which is usually covered in a per diem cost or allowance, and then various incidentals that come up during travel. Those other direct costs that we mentioned, that's a cost category that covers expenses for supplies and equipment, conference call lines, WebEx, printing and postage, especially if you're doing something like mailing out a survey, and then various other kinds of supplies and equipment. There are some potentially high-cost items in this category. If you're going to buy a survey instrument that's already been developed off the shelf, that could be pretty expensive. If you're buying a new data collection system, or if you're purchasing an existing data set, those could also be potentially high-cost items. So overhead costs for large evaluation firms are often built into their loaded labor rates. But just be aware that university staff or private consultants might account for overhead a little bit differently. The fees that these organizations charge for evaluation will depend on the type of contract. So for federal agencies like CNCS, we typically issue contracts that are cost plus fixed fee or time and materials or firm fixed price. You know, details aren't really important except to make the point that the type of contract for evaluation services can vary, and you just need to know what kind of contract you want to issue. Importantly, as I mentioned earlier, you have to account for the fact that there might be significant investments of program staff time spent on activities like quality control and monitoring, and this can raise the overall cost of your evaluation. But these activities are very important. They might not appear on a spreadsheet of direct costs, but you have to take this into account. So consider that you're going to account for staff time to meet with the evaluator, staff time to facilitate connections between the evaluator and site staff, additional time that you might use to produce derivative products, derivative communication materials, the quality control that we've talked about, so monitoring, check-ins, those are real costs, but it's very important because the monitoring work that you invest is going to prevent much more costly mistakes later. And then finally, the last item here is building data systems. So this is a very wise investment that's going to pay for itself many, many times over, but you probably will incur some upfront costs that you have to account for. So this slide has an example evaluation budget. It's here only for illustrative purposes, and it's just a hypothetical example. The point really is just to show that if you look at the first column, the staff time, you'll see that there's various kinds of staff members listed, and each one is charging a slightly different hourly rate depending on their level of experience. If you look also across the columns, you'll see that each of those staff members is spending different amounts of time on each of the different tasks, depending on their expertise and the particular area they've been trained in. And then finally, the last point here is that it's important to think about evaluation budgeting on a multi-year time frame. So think about evaluation in a three-year cycle, where the first year is used for planning, the second year is often used for data collection, and then that third year is used for analysis and reporting. And it's not uncommon for evaluation costs to vary across those years because the evaluation's activities vary. So in this example, you see that there's less cost in year one, the planning year, but then increased costs in year two when there was data collection, and then in year three, when the analysis and reporting was happening. So remember, not everyone's going to use an external evaluator. Small AmeriCorps programs that receive less than $500,000 a year could instead choose to conduct an internal evaluation. So in that case, though, the components of an internal evaluation budget are really not that different from an external evaluation budget at all. So you have to consider staff time and resources to conduct new data collection that might be needed or enhance existing data collection. You have to consider travel that might go beyond the scope of normal program operations, additional analysis that you may need to conduct, and then time to manage any consultants that you might have brought on. So you have to cover these costs somehow. You really can't expect your program staff to cover these costs in their free time or in addition to their normal workloads. So think creatively about who you can use on this project, which staff, how much time. Think if you can utilize some site staff, potentially some interns, or maybe even other volunteers who could help with some components of the evaluation. So here's a couple budgeting tips that we hope will be helpful as you design your evaluation budgets. So first, it can be really helpful to create two versions of a budget, a high and a low estimate, knowing that your true costs are likely going to fall somewhere in the middle. Second, it can be very helpful to talk to colleagues and partners about what they spent on their evaluations, as long as they were similar size and scope. In this vein, you know, we'd encourage you to consult with budgeting experts or staff members who are familiar with contracting or procurement processes. They often have a really big wealth of knowledge about typical costs and how you can maximize resources. You should always talk to staff who work in the locations where data collection is going to happen, so you can better determine what systems are already in place, what new systems you may need to create, and then how you can collect data most efficiently and effectively. You should discuss your budget with other stakeholders who've been involved in the evaluation planning process to make sure that you have reasonable assumptions and that everyone's on the same page. And then finally, as in all things, it's really wise to plan for contingencies. Be prepared to adjust your evaluation budget along the way as needed, because things inevitably come up. So there are some challenges to about doing evaluation on the cheap. So quality control and monitoring become much more important when you use cost-cutting options. Specific challenges you may face with lower cost evaluation options include the five items that we've listed here. So first, a lack of continuity. So if you use an option like a student group to conduct your evaluation, that means you may need to transition the project between a number of different evaluators, particularly if you think about that three-year time frame that I was talking about. Each of those transition points is a chance to lose continuity and context of the work. So there are some great students out there, graduate students particularly, who could be a really valuable resource, but just make sure you have someone who's monitoring them and if there's oversight to make sure that there's some continuity in the project. Second is a lack of appropriate expertise to conduct the evaluation. So if you use internal staff or less experienced evaluators who are cheaper, they frankly may not have the training or expertise you need to execute your study, and that could affect the quality of the results. The third point here is an underpowered study. So frequently, evaluations will sacrifice what we call statistical power, which comes from having a large sample size, so they'll sacrifice that in order to lower costs. So if you are going for a smaller sample, for example, that means less data to collect, less follow-up work you have to do. So that would seem to be cheaper. However, an underpowered study that uses too small of a sample frequently doesn't produce the useful information that you really need to answer your research questions. A small sample, an underpowered study, could even fail to detect an effect that's actually happening. So in other words, even if your program is achieving the outcomes that you want to achieve, if your sample size is too small, you may not be able to see that in the data. The next point is poor communication. So you may end up with a research product that's obscure, difficult to interpret, impossible for you to use. So it's really important that you can translate your evaluation work into something that your stakeholders can understand, but that may not be part of the process in a really cheap evaluation. And then finally, the last point is too many unanswered questions. So inexpensive workarounds can oftentimes lead to unanswered research questions or partially answered research questions. So an evaluation on the cheap just may not produce the depth or the breadth of information that you wanted. So now, on the other hand, what are some tips for cutting costs and still retaining quality? So one important theme mentioned earlier is that evaluation costs are largely driven by data sources and the technical expertise that's required for analysis. So if you can answer most of your research questions with existing program data, perhaps extended to a comparison group, or with administrative data, and with relatively simple analyses, you can lower your costs significantly. We would encourage you to develop internal staff capacity for evaluation work. So that's going to increase staff buy-in for evaluation and will make your staff better prepared to work with an external evaluator. Furthermore, don't hesitate to try to engage pro bono experts in your evaluation. Like I said earlier, local colleges, universities, cooperative extensions, they often have experts trained in evaluation who may jump at the opportunity to use their skills to help you. A good place to start is social science departments or public policy schools. If they can't help, they can likely direct you to someone else on campus who can. Finally, one additional low-cost strategy for evaluations is to focus your efforts on replicating an evidence-based model with fidelity. So hopefully by now you've seen the guidance that we recently released on approval for an alternative evaluation approach. So we will approve an alternative evaluation approach for a grantee that's replicating an evidence-based model with fidelity, as long as you also do an implementation evaluation. So this can be a strategy for small and large programs. And not only in that case, so not only do you not need to invest in a new impact evaluation, but you might in the process discover a great way to serve your local community even more effectively. So I want to emphasize again, I can't overemphasize this point, that it's so important to use program data that you're already collecting for your evaluation. So this can be data that you're collecting already for performance measures. It might be data you're collecting for other funders. Similarly, be creative in exploring how you might use administrative data in your evaluation. So this is things like student test scores, school attendance records, census data, unemployment insurance claims. This is a rapidly growing field, so you know, stay tuned for more guidance on best practices in using administrative data. And finally, try to build data collection into routine program operations from the start, rather than viewing it as a one-time exercise for a specific evaluation only. If you collect data regularly, it's going to pay dividends for years to come, and that's the case both for performance measurement and evaluation and for continuous program improvement. If you're a true learning organization, that means regularly collecting data and then using it to inform decision-making and ultimately improving your program. Okay, so I'm going to end with one more example of how you might think about allocating funds for evaluation. So again, a hypothetical program here has raised funds from CNCF, a state grant, an unrestricted foundation grant, a restricted corporate giving grant, and then it has organizational match, which is currently being used for personnel salary costs. So let's say they design an evaluation and they determine it's going to cost about $200,000. So where should that money come from? So first think about where can't we get money for evaluation? So looking at the sources here that we have, we can't use money for evaluation from the restricted corporate giving. And currently, our organizational match is being used for personnel costs. So what's left? Okay, so first of all, look at the state grant. So we can use up to 5% of the state grant for evaluation. That's $5,000 right there. We could use all $150,000 of the unrestricted foundation grant for evaluation. So now we're up to $155,000. That leaves $45,000 of the evaluation cost to come from CNCS. Similarly, you might also seek out some in-kind resources from community partners or community colleges, local resources that might be willing to help. So between the state grant, the unrestricted foundation grant, and CNCS funding, we've come up with $200,000. So $45,000 is about 10% of this organization's CNCS share, and that's very reasonable. But what if, let's say, this was more than you had currently budgeted for evaluation? So now you need to think about shifting some other costs out of the CNCS share and into other revenue sources. So think about what costs could you shift elsewhere, and how would you decide what costs to shift? So it's not an easy question, and the answer really depends a little bit on what sort of restrictions may or may not be in place on these other grants. So the unrestricted grants may or may not have restrictions on cost items other than evaluation. That's one thing to consider. But also think about what budget items are most appealing to other funders. So in general, the first thing to think about here is you're going to have to move as much as possible to the state grant and the restricted corporate giving, provided that those have no additional restrictions. So that's one way to think about shifting other costs out of CNCS to other sources, thereby freeing up CNCS money for evaluation. So the last part here is, what would you do if you found out that you couldn't shift all those costs to the state grant and to the corporate giving because they had restrictions? So what would you do? The one option here is, see if the organization would allow you to shift salary cost to the state grant or to the restricted corporate source instead. So that's another way to potentially free up that money. Another option, as I mentioned earlier, seek out additional unrestricted funding. So this again is just one example, but we want to get you thinking about how you allocate funds for evaluation, how you think about the whole pie of money that you have, and how you might be able to shift costs to meet your evaluation needs. So I'll end with a few more resources that may help you as you design and build an evaluation budget. These are resources that we found were particularly helpful both in developing this presentation and just generally thinking about budgeting. And then as Barbara mentioned earlier, we've put a number of resources on the Knowledge Network, the nationalresources.gov page, as well as a copy of this presentation and eventually the audio. So we're just about at an hour here. We have more time left over, so we want to open it up to any questions that you have, either for me, for Barbara, for Carla. You can feel free to say those. The phone line should be open, or to type them into the chat.
Hi, another conference call.
Any questions?
This is Janet from Nebraska. Can you tell me how we can get a copy of this presentation?
So there's a copy right now posted on the evaluation page of the Knowledge Network.
So okay.
It's already up there.
Great. Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah, hey, Diana, it's Barbara. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, I just wanted to let you know, I just reposted the link to the Knowledge Network of where this presentation is. I just put it in the chat box, so hopefully everyone who's on the WebEx can see that in their chat.
Great. And we would encourage you to not only view it, but share it with others. We're hopeful that, you know, we can get the information out through multiple channels.
Is there another question?
While we wait, Carla or Barbara, is there anything else you would like to add based on your own experience?
I don't have anything.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, Diana, I would just say I echo everything that you were saying about the sort of long-term planning for this. I think at the very beginning of your presentation, you talked about the multi-year agenda. I think setting an agenda out for several years and being able to kind of ramp up to the kind of process that you were going over in your presentation. I mean, that when I was at my commission and working with subgrantees, that was an incredibly, it was something that I just had to say over and over again, that we didn't expect people to go from 0 to 60, you know, in a really short period of time. So just definitely really want to echo that.
Right. And if anyone does have additional questions as they come up, I just send a note to the chat. So feel free to just send me a note, an email later. I've given you my email address there. I'd be happy to follow up on anything individually later. All right, so seeing no further questions, I think we can call it a day here.
Great, thank you so much, Diana.
Great, well, I just want to quickly thank everyone for coming. We really appreciate the interest, and we hope this was helpful.
Thank you.
At this time, all parties are welcome to go ahead and disconnect from today's conference. At this time, all parties are welcome to go ahead and disconnect from the call. Thank you so much for joining, and have a great day.
Great.